variance and being intentional about our trade-offs.
Monarchy is by definition incompatible with democracy. You cannot have a government chosen by election and at the same time have individuals occupying positions of power simply because they were born the sons or daughters of families who already have political power. It was on this principle that the English people fought a civil war, made a revolution, and cut off their king's head in the 17th century. When, after 10 years of being one of the first republics in the world, a monarch was restored to the British throne, it came to be understood that no king or queen would ever seek to rule without Parliament. Indeed, as Britain became a democracy, supporters of the parliamentary system insisted that the British monarchy has no real political power. The Victorian political theorist Walter Bagehot, for instance, wrote that the monarchy was merely a decorative part of the constitution and that real power was exercised by the cabinet. But even now, in the 21st century, is this really true? The royal family is, apart from anything else and beyond dispute, very wealthy, and money is one sort of power. And we pay for the royal family to remain wealthy. Their cost to the taxpayer has been estimated to anywhere between £40 million and £200 million. More than this, recent reports have revealed how much the royal family routinely seeks to directly and personally change the decisions of government. Here we look at how the hereditary power of the royal family still has an impact on the course of British political life.
The power behind the throne. Part 2.
BAE Systems, Britain's leading arms manufacturer, recently sold 72 Typhoon fighter jets to the Saudi Arabian dictatorship. The original offer from the Saudis was £4.4 billion. But when the deal was done, Ian King, BAE's chief executive, said the public was never going to know how much money the company was eventually paid. But one thing we do know is that on the very eve of the day that the deal was signed, Prince Charles was one of the Saudis' guests in the capital, Riyadh, dressed in traditional robes and joining the Saudi princes in a sword dance.
Well, the deal with Saudi Arabia was for 72 Eurofighter jets, which are made by BAE Systems. And the deal was worth £4.4 billion to BAE Systems, and funnily enough was signed the day before their otherwise disappointing results for 2013 were released, and while Prince Charles is in Saudi Arabia wining and dining with the heads of the regime who they were pursuing to get the final cost. I'd make the point that David Cameron had visited Saudi Arabia himself in November last year trying to cement this deal, and David Cameron had failed to do it. So it looks an awful lot like Prince Charles went over and did BAE's dirty work for them.
Prince Charles has been, by his own admission, a kind of mascot for British arms trade, so much so that even he has complained about being used to market weapons in his perhaps more sober moments. But this is still a man who, this is his job, and you can see here where there is, it's a job that's been done, there's a role that the royal family always carry out, regardless of, you know, whether they have a sort of momentary crisis of conscience or whatever. But it remains the case that up until very recent years and months, the royal family, and Prince Charles in particular, have been responsible for closing very big arms deals, particularly with Saudi Arabia. This is another monarchy which can probably does actually beat the royal family in terms of its just reactionary nature. This is a regime that regularly decapitates people for adultery and witchcraft and drug use and anything you can name, really. So this is thoroughly reactionary and state, and one that has committed crimes against humanity, that the British monarchy have rubber stamped these kinds of sales.
The palace denied that the princes, Saudi and British, discussed the arms deal.
One of the key questions is, why do the Saudi Arabian government or the Bahraini regime or any others want to have Prince Charles or Prince Andrew go over to their country and shake hands and greet and be taken around tourist sites? And the reason is because it gives them legitimacy. It gives a British endorsement. What it says is that not just is the United Kingdom prepared to do business with you, we are prepared to send over one of the heads of state to go over and do our bidding. And what it says is that Prince Charles is being used by BAE Systems and is being used as an arms dealer.
A previous investigation into UK-Saudi arms deals, Margaret Thatcher's sale of Tornado aircraft in the Al Yamama deal, was blocked by Tony Blair on national security grounds.
Prince Andrew's done more than his fair share of whining and dining with some of the most repressive regimes and dictators in the world. Earlier this year, Prince Andrew was in Bahrain as part of Great British Week, where he went over with some of the great British companies, companies like BAE Systems and other arms companies, Rolls-Royce, who were there specifically to sell weapons and to make deals with some of the most repressive governments in the world.
There is a direct relationship between what the royal family are doing in relation to arms sales and in relation to imperial wars, let it be said, because, of course, members of the royal family serve in the armed forces, and by serving in the armed forces, Harry in Afghanistan, for example, what they do is they put a kind of gloss on those kinds of imperial interventions. So the royal family is involved in the imperialist wars in that sense, is giving its blessing to those imperialist wars, and selling arms to Saudi Arabia is selling arms to an extremely reactionary monarchy with an appalling human rights record. An appalling record on civil liberties, which is also using its military power, projecting its military power elsewhere to suppress revolutionary movements in Bahrain 2 or 3 years ago and currently in Yemen.
Former South African MP Andrew Feinstein resigned in protest over BAE bribery allegations. He has his own experience of the royal family's arms interests.
We tried to investigate a huge and very corrupt arms deal. BAE won the contract in very controversial circumstances. The plane that the Air Force wanted was 2.5 times less expensive than the BAE offering and was far more suited to South Africa's needs. But the Metropolitan Police have estimated that £115 million in bribes were paid on that one deal alone. And unfortunately, the British royal family were intimately involved, together with Tony Blair, the then Prime Minister, in persuading the new South African government to buy these trainers and jet fighters, to the extent that the then Royal Yacht Britannia was sailed to Cape Town Harbour with some members of the royal family aboard, and they invited to dinner those ministers who were going to make the crucial decision about the BAE Systems.
Strangely, perhaps, a Buckingham Palace spokesman who spoke to The Guardian had much the same view, with an added tinge of colonial snobbery. Middle East potentates like meeting princes. He comes in as the son of the Queen, and that opens doors that otherwise would remain closed. He can raise problems with the Crown Prince, and 4 or 5 weeks later, we discover that the difficulties have been overcome and the contract can be signed. He brings an immeasurable value in smoothing the path for British companies. We don't send him to developed countries like France and Sweden, where a member of the royal family would not make a difference. But in developing countries or the Far East, a prince can get in because of who he is.
One of the characteristics of British capitalism, the British economy in recent times, really I suppose since the Second World War, has been that the arms industry
has played a very important role in the British economy and in British trade. The British are very keen to sell top-of-the-range weapons technology. Very often, the market is dictators, particularly dictators in the Middle East and North Africa. And if you want to establish diplomatic relations and trading relations with feudal or semi-feudal regimes in the Middle East and North Africa, it helps if you've got your own royals who can operate at that social level, who can give you an entree. So Prince Charles has played a major role, Prince Andrew has played a major role, other royals, I'm sure, as well, have played a role in developing these diplomatic relations and helping arms manufacturers to sell weapons to Middle Eastern dictators.
Unlike the case of Prince Andrew, when there have been other members of royal families in other parts of the world who have got involved, for instance, in the arms trade and behaved inappropriately, they suffer consequences. For instance, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands at one point was promoting arms sales into the Netherlands and was working with two American companies to do so. Neither of the companies realized he was working for the other, and his wife, the Queen of the Netherlands, didn't know he was working for either of them. When it was discovered that he was engaged in this activity, he was stripped of all sorts of rights and privileges, and he was never allowed to wear the uniform of the Dutch military ever again. Now, having a royal family is not ideal, but if one has one for whatever historical reasons, at least make them accountable and answerable for their actions, whereas in this country they can effectively do as they like.
But Andrew's particular form of charm worked as well on dictators whether or not they were of the royal variety. He is reported to have had a close friendship with Saif Gaddafi, son of Colonel Gaddafi, and hosted a lunch at Buckingham Palace for the son-in-law of Tunisian dictator Ben Ali, despite being warned of his corrupt activities by the British Embassy in Tunis. As for the Saudi government, the biggest market for UK arms companies, they are now using those arms in an unprovoked attack on neighbouring Yemen. In the world of international diplomacy, it is usual to distinguish between a nation's hard power and its soft power. The hard power of the US, for instance, is its military capacity and its economic strength. Its soft power might be the cultural influence of Hollywood, the social influence of its press, or the good feeling felt by millions of children around the globe towards Ronald McDonald or Captain America.
The soft power of the UK is considered to be a persuasive approach using cultural and economic means, whereas the UK hard power would be considered to be military might, aggression, war or policing.
So it is with the British monarchy. Part of its power, as we have seen, is its hard power, the power of wealth, of landed property, of direct political influence. But perhaps it has even greater influence in its exercise of soft power, the ideological and cultural influence the royal family exerts in British society.
Well, I think in terms of the soft and hard power, so to speak, of the royal family, there are there's a clear backstop to everything that happens in British democratic life. They do sanction any political party that comes into power. In fact, in the 1970s, they overturned the election of a progressive prime minister in Australia because it went so far against the interests of the royal family. So they actually do have the power to overturn governments. These things are very rarely used partly because to do that does actually draw into public awareness the actual power the monarchy has. Like the Black Spider members, we're told that actually no, they're just a kind of, you know, they're just the icing on the cake. They're just a kind of tourist attraction. They're just, you know, symbolic figureheads and so on. But actually, with the Black Spider members, you find out no, they're actually interfering in daily life on a regular basis. Around the Scottish independence campaign, you see that they're actually interfering in the democratic process that's going on inside Britain. So there's always the kind of a dance between their soft and their hard power. So when they use it, when they bring out the big guns, they actually expose themselves. So they're very careful. The British ruling class is very careful about how they, where they step in and where they don't step in.
It's very difficult to actually tell what power and influence the monarchy has over this government because it's so secret. It's like the rest of the corporate lobbying industry in this country is all done behind closed doors, or as David Cameron likes to say, it's a quiet word. You know, we don't know who's speaking to whom, we don't know who's having a quiet word with whom about which policies. So I see it as actually the tip of a very large iceberg. We have a £2 billion industry that we know nothing about, and the royalty are part of that. I mean, they're exceptional because they have this kind of magic sheen around them, which is the pomp and the costumes and the dressing up that they do. And so we don't sort of question their influence as much as we should. But we should look at really who out of everybody. I mean, we should look at the whole industry. And they are lobbyists. They have private commercial interests.
The royal family is quite deliberately used by the British establishment as a traditional symbol of the hierarchical and elitist society as a whole.
The media collaborates in the cover-up. It collaborates in massaging the news in order to downplay anything which is critical of the royal family. And what it also does is it pumps up all of the kind of bread and circuses nonsense, the Hello magazine type celebrity culture which surrounds them. So there's a royal wedding or there's a royal baby or whatever, and they turn it into a jamboree, which is like something out of ancient Rome or something out of medieval England. A completely kind of feudal sort of obsession with these extraordinarily rich.
After all, if people in Britain can be got to accept one incredibly wealthy individual whose position as nominal head of state and church and chief of the armed forces is hereditary, then why should they not accept an entire ruling elite based on similarly undemocratic principles? The existence of the monarchy is based on the idea of perpetual inequality as a natural order. It bolsters the old adages that seek to ensure that the status quo remains undisturbed. This is the world where the poor are always with us, where there will always be the rich man in his castle and the poor man at his gate.
If the purpose of the monarchy is as a tourist attraction, we should do two things. We should add a small levy onto the taxes and fees that tourists pay to come into the UK anyway. And that's how we could fund the British monarchy, rather than it being funded through hard-earned taxpayers' pounds and pence. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if what they're meant to be is a tourist attraction, then they should stay well out of any public debates, that constitutionally they shouldn't be involved in any way. So Prince Andrew should not be rushing around the world like a buffoon, selling British weapons to highly inappropriate governments. Prince Charles should not be writing letters to people in decision-making positions to try and ensure that his vision of what the United Kingdom should look like architecturally is imposed on the country. Then they can be just a tourist attraction, then I would have less of a problem with them. But as long as we are paying for their extremely luxurious lifestyle, I think we also have a right to determine what they do and don't do.
This is a world where the poor and disadvantaged are supposed to find solace in gazing on the finery of the royals, where everything from the crown jewels to Kate Middleton's wedding dress is supposed to bring glamour to lives where even small luxuries cost a week's wages. The majority of the press encourage us to forget our own troubles and worry about the happiness or otherwise of the characters in the royal soap opera. William and Kate's happy marriage, Diana and Charles's unhappy marriage, are talked about as if they matter more than the trials and joys of our own friends and relatives.
They have a very sophisticated PR machine. They are a brand that needs to be looked after, and they engage in any other practices that any other entity, brand, engages in. So any bad stories they will seek to quash and keep out of the media, and they will pump it full of good stories.
the unacceptable racist ramblings of the Duke of Edinburgh are suppressed. The unfortunate nonsense let slip by Prince Andrew is excused. The less appealing members of the family, like Fergie, are hidden from view or expelled from the clan.
And it is worth remembering that this is not a family who've exactly covered themselves in glory by the way they've behaved. I mean, Prince Andrew's father, the Duke of Edinburgh, has on numerous occasions been overheard making quite racist comments, highly inappropriate comments. I mean, one of the younger members of the royal family, Prince Harry, found it amusing to dress up in a Nazi uniform for a fancy dress party.
Every charitable gesture or good work, on the other hand, is magnified. It is the work of PR experts, spin doctors, and the loyal royal correspondents. But it is a national myth, and only partly believed.
The royal family is of course, packaged as a family of people who are doing all sorts of good works, who are raising money for charity and that kind of thing. And of course, that's all part of the packaging. It's a necessary part of the packaging. The reality is quite different. The reality is that they are a central institution in a very conservative and traditional political order. But they are also, despite the fact they are in a sense a leftover from feudalism, they're also doing the business of modern British capitalism.
The UK would be far better off without a monarchy, just in terms of monetary value. The £45 billion that they're worth could be redistributed to a whole host of good causes, social workers, firefighters, the homeless, etc., etc. In this time of austerity, supposedly there's a 600% rise in food banks. Why doesn't the Queen or the monarchy just distribute one of their palaces, one of their castles to that? There's people going hungry in this country, and I don't see the Queen participating in the austerity movement. And we'd have a more democratic country. We as people would no longer be subjects, we'd be citizens. And finally, just to add one more thing, it's still technically illegal to discuss republicanism as an alternative to monarchy. That's something that needs to be repealed in Parliament immediately if we're to be taken seriously as a democratic country.
Despite the years of pro-royal propaganda, some 30% think the UK would be better off without a monarch. That figure rises to 50% in Scotland. Some 60% are against Prince Charles becoming king when the current Queen dies.
The easiest question to answer is, would the UK be better off without the royal family? Yes, it would. And of course, it wouldn't be the UK. It wouldn't be a united kingdom. It would be a democratic country. In fact, it would be much smaller in an ideal world. It wouldn't encroach into any of the landmass of Ireland. It wouldn't encroach even into Scotland. That's clearly said. Over 50% now actually want to separate. Most people, over 60%, admit it's inevitable that there will be a separation. This can only be a good thing, because this sort of bundle of different small countries in a small part of the European landmass, or just off the European landmass, have had exponential, disproportionate and destructive range over the entire planet for centuries, and I think for that to come to an end can only be a good thing, really.
There is no question at all that Britain would be a much healthier place without the monarchy. But the monarchy is only one of a number of antiquated institutions which are barriers to real democracy. The House of Lords is another. Our dysfunctional electoral system, our first-past-the-post system, is a third. And there are many others that one could think of. The British political system needs a radical overhaul, even to create a modern parliamentary democracy, and we need to see very, very radical changes indeed in the way in which we make decisions if the interests of ordinary people are going to be reflected going forwards.
There is likely to be a crisis of confidence, if not a constitutional crisis, when the Queen is succeeded by Charles. It will be a moment when ordinary citizens in the UK have to examine whether an hereditary, hugely wealthy, unconstitutionally influential, politically reactionary institution is still the best adornment for a supposedly democratic society in the 21st century.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
11 months into President Joe Biden's term, the United States has recorded 800,000 COVID-19 deaths, over 300,000 of those on his watch, the highest total and per capita of the group of seven wealthiest nations. We'll prepare for you an article written by Jeff Mason. The piece is titled, Experts Say Rising Cases, Omicron Highlight Holes in Biden's COVID Strategy. Amid a new surge in COVID-19 cases and deaths ahead of the Christmas and New Year holidays, US President Joe Biden is drawing criticism from health experts who are calling for more urgency, more testing, wearing of face masks and global vaccine sharing. President Biden, a Democrat, took office in January, pledging to get the coronavirus under control. He presided over a massive vaccine rollout and passed a $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package, a sharp contrast with his predecessor, Republican Donald Trump, who downplayed the pandemic's severity, dismissed many preventive measures, and undermined health experts. However, 11 months into Joe Biden's term, the United States has recorded 800,000 COVID-19 deaths, over 300,000 of those on his watch, the highest total and per capita of the group of seven wealthiest nations. As the Omicron variant bears down and people gather for the holiday season, hospitals in some areas are seeing record high numbers of COVID-19 patients. According to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, Biden's vaccination push has led to 65.2% of the eligible population being fully vaccinated. Republican-led opposition means that figure is less than 50% in some states. Less than 30% of the population has an additional booster shot believed necessary to protect against Omicron. Health experts are saying the U.S. administration needs to push mask wearing, increase pressure on companies to bring down the cost of tests, share technology on vaccines globally, and secure more funding to fight the pandemic on a broad scale. Many say the White House had let such measures slide while focusing on getting people inoculated. Greg Gonsalves, an associate professor of epidemiology at Yale University, said, "Where's the leadership that asks for national sacrifice at a time of emergency?" He said, "President Biden should get on television tonight and say, 'I want you to mask up.'" The White House has repeatedly claimed it has the tools to fight Omicron without shutting schools and businesses, while promising more tests and widespread booster distribution. Biden will speak in coming days about new plans, including driving home his message to unvaccinated Americans to get a shot, and for those who are vaccinated to get a booster shot. Broadway theaters, universities, and professional sports leagues are already cancelling or postponing events, reflecting the reality of a new COVID-19 wave. Biden's toughest challenge fighting the pandemic has been political. Misinformation spread through social media platforms and pushback on health measures, driven largely by Republican politicians and conservative media, have thwarted his efforts to persuade pockets of the U.S. population to get vaccinated. The Biden administration vowed early on to crack down on private companies spreading vaccine-related misinformation, but it persists. Dr. Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, says, "I think U.S. officials underestimated the fact that the anti-vaccine movement was first and foremost a political movement." He said a leading killer of young and middle-aged adults in the United States is anti-science aggression from the far right. The White House has sought to depoliticize the issue, sending health officials onto Fox News Channel, even as the cable channel's conservative commentators sowed doubt about vaccines and wearing of face masks. A White House official said despite their sometimes significant differences, the White House sees Fox News as an important outlet to disseminate public health information, including on Biden's Omicron strategy. The president has sparred with Republican governors whose policies clash with his. More recently, his rhetoric has been less political, focused directly on urging people to get a vaccine shot. On Thursday, 16th of December, he sounded a grim warning, predicting a winter of severe illness and death for those who are unvaccinated. Biden said earlier this month the government would require private health insurers to reimburse their 150 million customers for the cost of over-the-counter at-home COVID-19 tests, and make 50 million tests available free through rural clinics and health centers for the uninsured. But critics call that insufficient. Angela Rasmussen, an American virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada, says, "There's more uninsured Americans than that, and what we were only supposed to take one rapid test ever. These policies are completely inadequate." Surging demand for COVID-19 tests from U.S. employers bringing employees back to work exacerbated a nationwide shortage of rapid tests in the fall, driving up costs for state and local testing programs. The recent spike in cases has led to long testing lines across the country and left Americans scrambling to secure at-home tests at pharmacies and online. The White House claimed there are tens of thousands of free testing sites across the country. The supply of at-home tests has quadrupled, and a dozen new rapid tests has been authorized to come to the market. A White House official claimed, "We're working with governors and state and local health officials to add more capacity. We're also working with manufacturers to expand capacity." Former director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Tom Frieden, told Reuters news agency, "The administration also needs to step up the promotion of mask wearing, and that subsidizing the costs of face masks or distributing them could help." He said, "Masks and vaccination are by far the two most important interventions, and it's still far too hard for someone to find out the quality of a mask they're buying to get masks at a reasonable price. It's still too much of a wild west out there in terms of the market. The Omicron variant that is prolonging the global crisis may not be the last, as vast majorities of people in less developed nations remain unvaccinated, giving the virus room to mutate." Experts said the Biden administration could have done more to get vaccines to the rest of the world, protecting other populations and Americans as well. Noting the new Omicron variant came from abroad, Greg Gonsalves says, "There's been sort of an ongoing battle with the White House to do more." Meanwhile, top U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci has warned of a new high in the number of deaths over the latest variant of COVID-19, the Omicron variant. Dr. Fauci made the comments during an interview with CNN, in which he was asked whether he expected new record high numbers for cases as well as hospitalizations and deaths. Fauci confirmed by saying, "I think that is going to happen. We are going to see a significant stress in some regions of the country on the hospital system, particularly in those areas where you have a low level of vaccination, which is one of the reasons why we continue to stress the importance of getting those unvaccinated people vaccinated." He added that US officials were aware of the possibility of a new variant, but did not expect it to have so many mutations. Dr. Anthony Fauci added, "We definitely saw variants coming. I think what one referred to, what was not anticipated, was the extent of the mutations and the amino acid substitutions in Omicron, which is really unprecedented." Anthony Fauci added, "It kind of came out of nowhere, where you have a virus that has 50 mutations, 30 of which are in the spike protein, and 10 or 12 of which are in the receptor binding domain. I mean, to me, that's really quite unprecedented." He further anticipated tough times for US hospitals and the healthcare sector in the effort to handle the new variant of the coronavirus. Dr. Fauci said, "It is going to be tough. We can't walk away from that. We can't, because with Omicron that we're dealing with, it is going to be a tough few weeks to months as we get deeper into the winter." The Omicron variant, which was found in the US earlier this month, is said to have a much higher transmissibility than the previous variants of the coronavirus. Dr. Fauci told NBC earlier, "Well, the one thing that's very clear, and there's no doubt about this, is its extraordinary capability of spreading, its transmissibility capability. It is just, you know, raging through the world, really. Omicron was first detected in South Africa last month and soon spread across many countries, including in the Americas and in Europe." According to the World Health Organization, WHO, Omicron is expected to become the dominant version of the virus. Thank you.
Gazar.
Iran has a rich history in weaving carpets, dating back to over 2,500 years ago. Originally, Persian carpets were woven by traveling nomads to cover floors and gears, which are round dwellings that are easily packed up. Persian carpets are adored all over the world. In fact, the most expensive Persian rug ever bought was a 17th century Persian vase-style carpet, which was sold at an auction in 2013 in London for over $33 million. The legacy and tradition of carpet making still remains in Iran, with intricate designs, lavish colors, and peerless artistry.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of Bazaar. This week, we will take a look at rural cooperatives in Iran while shining the spotlight on the production of traditional hand-woven carpets. We want to see how they are made and why they are so expensive. Also, we will check out how cooperatives help support this sector, which contributes millions to the economy. So, let's roll out the show.
A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost tens of thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of warm carpets and the strong compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on, but rugs made in Iran's Fars province are perhaps the most traditional carpets characterized by their bold designs. So our journey took us to a cooperative in this province near the city of Shiraz in order to see the production cycle of this valuable handcraft. This cooperative is made up of a chain of related trades for weaving carpets. First, we visited a dyeing complex. This facility is a massive 22,000 square meter area dedicated to boiling, spinning, and dyeing sheep's wool. The processes are all done by hand using natural plant-based dyes. It is probably the largest of its kind in the province and one of the oldest in this field, with over four decades of experience in traditional hand dyeing. One of the advantages of plant-based dyes is that they enrich the quality of wool over time, plus they are non-toxic. This facility supplies bright and elaborate yarns to another part of the cooperative, which is dedicated to weaving.
Hand woven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Carpet weaving in Fars is recognized as part of the UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage List. In this province, materials are distributed to small villages for women to weave in their homes or in cooperatives. And Fars province is famous for its magnificent Gabbeh carpets.
This weaving facility gets its supplies and yarns from other parts of the cooperative. Here, we were able to see the process of how carpets are woven. Looms for Gabbeh rugs are typically laid horizontally across the floor, making their production extremely labor-intensive. The process of weaving a Persian rug differs slightly with each variety, but generally speaking, a bed of foundation material called warp is installed into the frame. Starting at the bottom, weavers then feed wool in between the warp, tying knots on each one. A highly detailed silk rug can have around 170 knots per square centimeter. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather their materials, design, and overall size. While some varieties of Persian rugs follow design specifications, Gabbeh carpets are often completely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs such as goats, trees, and dolls. This weaving facility also offers training courses for handmade traditional carpets. These establishments are particularly important for women. Much of the traditional carpets woven here are made by the dexterous hands of ladies, which also generates income for them.
Thank you.
This cooperative is one of 1,900 cooperatives scattered around the country. Currently, there are over 100 carpet weaving complexes and over 5,000 centralized and non-centralized workshops nationwide, too. That's based on figures from the National Carpet Center.
Women in rural areas play a key role in the agriculture sector, which provides wool and silk and cotton to weavers. The statistics show there are 10 million rural and nomadic women who contribute to agricultural production in the country. That's around 49% of the entire rural community. And cooperatives help protect the hard-earned income of women as well.
Despite Iran's rich history of producing handmade rugs, the tribal rugs produced in rural villages could be under threat from a lack of young weaving talent. So cooperatives play a big role in reviving and sustaining this ancient tradition. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers, who frequently receive the least amount of profits from their products. This is mainly because there are a lot of middlemen who make money from carpets. With that in mind, cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the chain of production by linking producers of material with weavers and weavers with buyers, which completes a production cycle. There are many opportunities for investment in the field of carpet weaving, especially in the field of dyeing, spinning, and livestock. Millions of Iranians are directly employed in rug making, and many more indirectly. Also, there are numerous export markets available. It might be interesting to know that one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets is the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, due to the U.S.-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find other indirect avenues to purchase these highly coveted carpets, which reduced the profits returning to the country.
Now, hand-woven carpets typically get center stage in the textile industry. But Iran also makes large quantities of machine-made carpets with very high quality. Iran's carpet industry has maintained the integrity of its products while adjusting to modern demands. There are thousands of designs to choose from for nearly all purposes. And Iran also exports its carpets in large quantities.
Iran is one of the top 10 global exporters of machine-made carpets. The major exporters are China, Turkey, India, and Belgium. That's all according to the Ministry of Industry. Based on the same figures, Iran has a potential capacity to produce over 120 million square meters of machine-woven carpets with some 1,300 production units nationwide. Innovation in production has been one of the pillars of speed. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran exported around $110 million worth of machine-made carpets in the first 6 months of this year. So far, carpets have been sent to 54 destination markets around the world. Industry participants say exports could have been higher last year if it wasn't for border closures due to the COVID-19 outbreak. Iran also exports hand-woven carpets. In fact, the statistics from the Customs Administration shows there was a 14% increase since last year. Exports of these items have generated well over $82 million in hard currency in the first quarter of this year. The government has plans to increase its exports through promoting online sales as well as pursuing Chinese markets. Around 3.5 million square meters of handmade carpet are woven in the country each year. That's according to Iran's National Carpet Center. Roughly 80% of carpets produced domestically are exported. Plants grow and give fruits and flowers when they are in the most ideal circumstances. Proper amount of sun, water, soil conditions, and the right temperature are all the ingredients for a happy plant to grow and do what it does best. These days, being a successful farmer is a much more complicated and demanding profession than in the past. Farmers today not only need to have great agricultural skills, but they also must have exceptional technological and marketing expertise. And the most recent trend in farming are greenhouses.
In this program, we will explore new developments in Iran's vast agriculture industry while shining the spotlight on greenhouses. We wanted to see what all the fanfare is about with this type of farming. Plus, we will also check out how it's making profits in the agriculture sector.
Our journey began at Farrakesh the Parsian. This company has been around for decades and has a rich history of activity in livestock rearing and farming. Some years ago, it launched a new business specializing in high-tech hydroponic greenhouses. It's an indoor farm with greenhouses built on many hectares of land. Mainly, it grows three types of produce and a variety of tomatoes, peppers, and lettuce. Each year, it may focus on growing a single type of crop, such as peppers. They have perfected Mother Nature indoors through a combination of science and technology married with farming. The goal is to provide sustainable indoor farming solutions that optimize the use of natural resources. Hydroponic greenhouses grow crops in nutrient-rich water, so water management is at the heart of this company. The structures are created with state-of-the-art irrigation systems. Also, rainwater is collected and distributed to plants. Drainage from the plants is gathered in pools where it undergoes a purification process to remove contaminants, then recycled back into the system. But that's not all. Special ventilation systems control temperature and air circulation. The greenhouses are equipped with shades to control natural light, plus they are fitted with heating and cooling systems. This type of farming comes at a time when the country is witnessing unprecedented heat and water shortages, partially because of outdated agricultural practices.
This type of farming is growing in popularity. The technical term for hydroponic farming is controlled environmental agriculture, or simply indoor farming. These greenhouses create precise growing conditions using technological advances like digital monitoring that draw out the best flavors and textures in produce. And they can be built almost anywhere.
Aside from being a major producer itself, this company offers its hydroponic technology to farmers and growers. Plus, it helps them plant their own greenhouses. It gets its seedlings from its own massive nursery. The seeds are hybrids that are imported. Using hybrid seeds helps grow crops that match international quality, which is beneficial when exporting their produce. This company collaborates with research and academic institutions for agricultural research of cash crops such as saffron and blueberries. The company stands on the threshold of exporting its produce and welcomes foreign investments to expand its activities. As part of their future vision, they are creating a program for on-site training, which helps users of hydroponic technology in glass greenhouses. Additionally, it is developing lodging and accommodation for national and international agritourists. The most recent addition to their line of work is a packing facility which packages produce and readies them for market distribution. While the U.S. sanctions do not directly cover the agriculture sector, they have indirectly impacted businesses in this industry. Much of the technology used in this company is imported or has spare parts that need to be imported. The sanctions have hindered international money transfers, making imports and even exports of produce for this company difficult.
As you might know, open land farming is vulnerable to environmental changes. Droughts, cold spells, heat waves, and soil erosion all impact harvests. The agriculture sector not only plays a big role in managing food security, but also was a big contributor to the Iranian economy. In recent years, water shortages have slowed development in this sector, which has gained the attention of government officials.
The Ministry of Agriculture defined several programs to develop greenhouses to tackle drought conditions. Right now, the total greenhouse area in the country stands at around 21,000 hectares. Government officials want to increase this amount to 25,000 by the end of the year. This will help support plans of the Ministry of Agriculture to transfer vegetable farms to greenhouses. The main objective is to save 10 billion cubic meters of water annually. Many of these greenhouses are set up in agriculture parks inside free trade zones. In fact, in the Northwest, Aras Free Trade Zone opened one of the biggest hydroponic greenhouse complexes in West Asia. The goal is to increase productions for exports. For this reason, agri-parks have a major role in developing technology to support efficient indoor farming. The government provided nearly $200 million worth of funds for creating agricultural parks and greenhouses last year. And this supportive measure has paid off, as over 4 million tons of fruits and vegetables were produced this year from greenhouses. Tehran province is one of the country's biggest producers of greenhouse products. Yazd, West Azerbaijan, Bushehr, and Khorasan provinces also have numerous greenhouses, just to name a few.
Iranian agriculture has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. It was one of the only sectors that was really impacted by the global coronavirus outbreak. Agriculture is not limited to cultivation and farming alone. It also includes dairy, poultry, beekeeping, aquaculture, and so much more. It is considered a strategic sector where goods are enhanced with added value through processing, promotion, and distribution.
Agriculture makes up 8% of Iran's GDP and employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. Iran's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports last year. That's according to the Ministry of Agriculture. Figures from the ministry show Iran has over 18 million hectares of arable land. And last year, nearly 130 million tons of agro products were produced in farmlands. Iran's agro industry is worth billions. Data from Iran's Customs Administration show the value of the country's agricultural exports rose by around 3% this year. Its figures also reveal Iran exported some 5 million tons of agricultural products worth nearly $3 billion this year. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list was pistachio, selling off roughly $540 million worth of nuts. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture products also generated $1 billion in exports. When one hears the name of the textile industry, the first thing that comes to mind is the multi-billion dollar fashion industry. That's partially true, but it turns out that textiles have many uses outside of the fashion world. They are an important part of the medical field, toy manufacturing, weaponry, agriculture, and other unexpected fields. The Industrial Revolution indeed expanded this industry over the years. All textiles are made of fibers, and innovation, speed, and flexibility have built the spinning sector as we know it.
We will explore the vast textile industry with a particular look at synthetic fibers. We wanted to see where this industry gets its raw material by looking at the contributions of petrochemical sector. We will uncover how synthetic fibers are made and why they are such an integral part of other upstream industries.
This week, our journey took us to an industrial complex in the town of Karchak near the capital Tehran. We wanted to see who helps tie the textile industry together, so we visited a manufacturer that specializes in producing synthetic threads. Nasojan Parsemehris was first established in 2016, and its main product is polyester thread. Its massive production hall has the capacity to produce tons of this item each day. Its products are sold to numerous textile companies across the nation. Mainly, its customers are manufacturers of fabrics for curtains, upholstery, and the garment industry, to name a few. Production all starts with polyester granules, which are made by the petrochemical industry. Partially oriented yarn is made from this material. Dozens of people are employed at the production lines who work in shifts around the clock. Production never really stops at this facility. Partially oriented yarn is a term used to describe a polyester thread that is not completely stretched. This creates a less uniform appearance and is used to make texture in fabrics. This company makes different types of threads which are used for different purposes in down-the-line industries.
Well, there are two main steps to making polyester thread. In the first step, chips are fed to a machine called the vacuum dryer. After roughly 12 hours, the moisture is reduced and then the material is fed through a hopper to an extruder where it is heated and melted. After other